Hi there, Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice Dyer in the Magnus Protocol. As part of the Magnus Archive's 10th anniversary, Rusty Quill is hosting a special Magnus Live show at the upcoming Crossed Wires Podcast Festival in Sheffield. Join co-creators Jonathan Sims and Alexander J. Newell on the 5th of July for a new iteration of our live show, Statement Begins, where you can hear fan-favourite statements such as Anglerfish, Red Live, and gain exclusive insights into the creation and history of the show straight from the creators themselves. You can buy your tickets now, including limited numbers of meet and greet tickets, from crossedwires.live or the link in the description of this episode.
Na, noch keine Pläne fürs Wochenende? Besucht die Rotkäppchen-Erlebniswelt in Freiburg mit euren Mädels, der Oma oder dem Knallertypen von nebenan. Wir lieben alle Jahrgänge. Entdeckt unsere interaktive Ausstellung bei der Erlebnistour mit Audioguide und einem Glas Sekt und genießt im Pavillon die ganze Welt von Rotkäppchen. Die Rotkäppchen-Erlebniswelt, nur eine Sektlänge entfernt.
Hi everyone, Alex here. I'd just like to take a moment to thank some of our patrons. Zed Perkins, Ivashia, Robert Groom, Asher Ufara, Niam Hemingway, Kyle, Joshua Groman, Rachel Oney, Malcolm Snipes, Alex Haydignac, Michelle Latour, Oscar Marlowe, Glory Duda, Joe Smith, Alex Freeman, Kate May, Xantha Boomer, Paul McHugh, Ciara McCabe, January Garcia. Thank you all. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, go to www.patreon.com/rustyquill and take a look at our rewards. Hi everyone, Alex again. Just taking a moment to give you a bit of Rusty Quill news ahead of today's episode. Firstly, we want to thank everyone for your support and dedication up to this point. It's been a wild ride and we could not have hoped for better people to end the world with. Secondly, in terms of the hiatus between seasons, we know it's a long one, but we really wanted to make sure that we had enough time to get things running as smoothly as possible for the final season. We appreciate your patience in this, and as a way of saying thanks, we're aiming to be releasing special season break content every fortnight or so. The first of which is today's episode, part one of our epic Q&A session for the later season. We have a bunch more special content planned, so keep an eye on the Magnus feed over the coming months. Finally, if you just can't handle the break even with these bonus goodies, we'd like to recommend to you season two of Outliers, the historic fiction podcast we produce alongside Historic Royal Palaces. This anthology tells the stories of people who have been sidelined by history, living in the shadows of real events at some of the greatest palaces ever built. It features original work from award-winning contemporary writers based on actual research by Historic Royal Palaces, and is accompanied by full soundscapes and musical production from Rusty Quill. This has been a really exciting project for us to have worked on, and we are thrilled to be able to present it to you. You can find all of Season 1 available via your podcatcher of choice, and Season 2 is happening right now. We'll include a link in the show notes. So once you're done with this episode, why not jump on over and give it a try? We really think you're going to enjoy it, and you may even recognise a few friendly voices. Anyway, that's enough from me. As always, thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Magnus Archive Season 4 Q&A. This is going to be one of two because we have a lot. I'm here with Johnny Sims.
There's a lot. There's a lot.
And we're going to be doing our best to get through all of the questions that have been raised since last time we did a Q&A. We are going to preface this, though, with going, we have more than 700 and it's still
like
going
a
up.
A lot, yeah. There's so many.
So it is going to be a case of, statistically speaking, your specific question isn't going to be asked, and we're sorry about that.
There were apparently quite a few that have been condensed down into over questions?
There's a couple of questions where more than 100 people asked some version of the same question. Yeah. So we should get through quite a lot of them. But yeah, we can't do all of them. We're going to do the best we can. And we're going to shake things up a little bit. Instead of going through sort of blocky, like one on cast, one on production, etc., we're now going to be separating it out a little bit. And I'm going to be shaking it up, keeping you on your toes.
Right. Going to be honest, I'm a bit nervous.
Well, this is a tricky one because we've taken bigger punts with this season, so we'll see how it goes.
And there are enough people listening out there now that I can feel the pressure of history upon me.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to have fun, you need to...
I can't have fun. Fun is... Fun, jokey answers are no longer...
No, it's great. You need to go on Google Trends at some point and look at the searches for Magnus Archives and look at that nice little logarithmic scale.
I don't know what's happened.
It's lovely.
Right.
Thank you, everyone who's recently joined us to listen. We 100% value you and are only a little bit scared.
Oh, no, he's terrified. I'm at this point so far beyond the pale, you just kind of roll with it. It's Alex like surfing an enormous wave.
Alex hasn't had feelings in some years.
That's true. In fact, straight out the gate, I'm going to use that as my in. So the first of our questions to do with cast. Alex, why do you hate Martin so much?
That's a real good question.
Okay, this is a very simple question that has come up more than once. I don't actively hate Martin. I just don't like him. And I've said it before, so I will just have to repeat my answer from before, which is he is a younger version of me when it comes to characterization. And when it comes to script editing, I've also done that as well. It is a version of me, or at least parts of him are a version of me from a while ago that needed to learn, and has now learned, actually, through season 4, that going around just trying to set yourself on fire to keep everyone else warm doesn't work. So I'm actually okay with Martin by end of season 4, for the simple reason that he stopped doing that thing.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with Martin now.
I really like him as a character. I find him, through season 4, he was quite difficult to write, because often there would be plot points that I needed him to deliver, and every time I tried to write him delivering them, it didn't sound right. It just sounded false in his voice.
Well, it's because Martin's default season 4 became, I'm kind of pissy right now.
Yeah.
Which makes exposition a bit difficult.
But we got there.
Oh, and that one's from Antiva. I need to remember to
yes.
Read the names.
Thank you.
Right. So we have a production question for both of us from Benja. How do you feel about being so close to the end of Magnus?
Excited and a little bit nervous, mainly.
Yeah, I think for myself, we're entering... So we're past the danger period of season 4, which was everyone might hate us for what we did.
Yeah, the big climax of season 4 is always going to be the part of the whole series that we were most like worried about. That it's been building for 4 seasons.
Yeah, yeah. For me, end of Magnus is scary for the same reason that any project you do which is scary, which is... You do your finale and everyone goes, that was fantastic. And then you're like, cool, here's this other thing that we're now working on that we think you'll really enjoy. And everyone goes, no, I'm good. One project per creative per lifetime.
Yeah.
That's the scare. That's
the
fear.
Yeah, that is a bit worrisome. Also, I have some slight nerves about season 5 just because for season 4, we knew the big drop we were going towards. And while we know the end of season 5 we're going to, but it's a different sort of journey.
Denouement are hard.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be the most technically difficult one for us to write without it necessarily being the most risky in terms of like ending the world with a season to go is a higher risk.
I'm just glad that here on tape you will confirm that you're happy for us to do approximately 40 unknowings in terms of audio editing.
I'm absolutely. You can write as many unknowings as you want. We're not going to make them. So you can just make those on your own, get yourself a wobble board and just have some fun.
Is that what you did?
I mean, I'm not going to go into that unless it's a question. So on to a story question from Ashley Desert Willow Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Limited swearing is done for real world release reasons, but is there any reason for it within the lore? Does the eye just not like cursing in its statements / meals?
I mean, there's no lore reason except that the characters we're writing aren't particularly sweary.
And I'm fairly certain they would have been more if I wasn't like, no.
I mean, oh yeah, no, there
this
was...
This hard, grizzled convict also cares a lot about cursing.
If it's of interest to anyone, there was the piecemeal episode was where this first came to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first draft of that, I filled it chock full of swears. And Alex, largely actually as a catalyst to have the conversation, and we had the conversation... And the swearing in that one was toned back a bit and we landed at the level that we've more or less continued. Personally, from a writing point of view, I 100% agree with Alex that it's really useful to be able to have some linguistic escalation.
Yes.
Available to you, which is hard when you've got a constant stream of expletives.
Pretty much that. I don't really have anything to add to that. Bang on. Okay, this one's a writing question. This is from Sy. This season had a lot of focus on characters' emotional conditions, motivations, and interpersonal relationships, all dealing with a lot of nuance. What part was the hardest to write convey, in your opinion, and what part did you want to get exactly right the most?
Ooh.
I am going to struggle to pick the most. I could pick sort of like a highlight reel because we had a lot in this one.
Yeah.
When we were doing season planning for this one, we actually put little sort of red markers on the bits that we knew we were going to have to focus on. So stuff like Melanie's decision.
Melanie's decision, I think, is one of the, like, a lot of the series was contextualizing, because the idea of Melanie doing that as an actually mentally healthy act, if that makes sense.
Really difficult.
It was something we really wanted to dive into, but not just from an emotional writing point of view, but from, I mean, there are people who are blind and saying, oh, this horrible thing, this
terrible
thing of being blind. Like, there's a lot to consider in order to not make it a really...
gauche.
I was going to say but a really bad piece of representation, and we wanted to take care to not do that.
Also treading the line for Peter in terms of everyone hates Peter because he's a real world villain instead of a I'm gonna eat your brains villain.
Yeah, the lonely, like diving into the lonely, I hadn't quite anticipated how close it would hew to real world depression. And it was one of those things that when you read it back, it's obvious. But it was only through the writing that I started to realise, oh, this is touching on some very real stuff. And so that was a very, tricky line to walk.
Another one that I think we put a marker down but actually turned out to seem to come out better than we feared it might is the sort of pseudo-addiction angle on the archivist statement giving, where that was one that we were aware could get away from you if you weren't being careful about it, but I don't think...
I think it seemed to land well.
Yeah, it seemed to land the way we wanted, which was not as a lazy analogue.
Yeah. I mean, as a whole, because season three was very dynamic, very going
moves.
Out there, like taking action, we wanted season four to be much more emotion focused, for the plot and the emotional arcs to be much more one and the same.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think for what it's worth, there are more. But then we're just going to start listing episodes and reasons that we had to be careful.
Oh, well, the difficulty with every relationship that got any play in the series, which is all of them.
You know what? Here's a one little extra bonus one, which made me chuckle.
Ooh, a bonus.
Again, I don't actually engage in the fan base that much anymore, just due to time constraints, if nothing else. But hearing that people were getting a bit antsy with Basira for being a bit sort of steamrollery and things.
Oh, yeah.
But the fact that Basira's the one who was right all season.
For a given value of right. Like, I mean, this is not a season where there is anyone who is right.
I'm just saying the Archivist did end the world.
Basira
had just given him a harder time, he might not have done.
If by a harder time you mean, you know, like a...
Just a complete stone-cold murdering.
But, if she could have... Who's to say? but no, like, this is the thing. Like, there are no simple answers. There are no, like, oh, this person was right and should have just done this.
That was the point of the season. On to a non-story one this time. This one is from, quote, loads of people.
Quote loads. Okay.
As in, that's an actual number, not a
bracing myself.
How much do you keep up with social media to see what fans are saying about Magnus, or does Anil keep tabs on all of us panopticon style and alert you when something significant comes up? I can answer for me, I can't answer for Johnny.
Sure.
Very much the latter for me at this point. It's like a personalised Google alert from Anil, who's like, listen, everyone does worry that you are anti-Martin. Is that a thing that we're going to need to discuss? But I haven't really had much chance to dive into anything. It's largely
because people were like, oh, Johnny, you're writing lots of horrible things happening to our beloved Martin. And I'm like, yes, it's a horror. It's a horror show. And they're like, why do you hate Martin? I'm like, actually, it's mostly Alex. And so it's my fault. I have 100% outsourced fan discontent onto you.
That's all good.
Because you're more insulated from it.
Ultimately, yeah. Because if anyone threatens me, I can just make Martin sadder.
Very true. I tend to, on release day, I will keep half an eye on the Reddit or the Tumblr, and I used to be the Discord. I still sometimes do, but it goes very fast, and I generally don't have a chance to actually properly engage with it. So immediately after an episode drops, I'll generally be trying to get a sense for how it's gone down and sense for what the reaction is. But I do rely on Adel to let me know if there's any problems or any, like, anything that's come up on social media that is like, oh, I should probably address that.
See, I feel like I've started to get a bit of a reputation as Gandalf the Grey, where I only tend to turn up in the Discord now if something's going wrong, as in, like, technically wrong, and I need to make sure it's releasing properly. So I mostly turn up with bad news and then leave.
To be fair, I'm enjoying my status as essentially some sort of chaos god within the Discord, where I'll just turn up and then everyone's like, oh, Johnny's here! And then I'll leave.
You'll leave Anil to clean up all of the mess that we make. Okay, cool. I'm going to jump back onto a cast one. One I've sort of answered already, actually. It's from Erin. How have your feelings on Martin as a character changed since season one? I can summarise this one really quickly.
Yep.
Much like a certain type of smelly cheese, Martin needed an ageing and maturing process in order to reach his full flavourful potential. At the start, he was very, very fluffy and just there as a nice little foil. As things progressed, it was, oh, there's a person underneath the foil. Oh, they're wonderful. Oh, they're not wonderful. They're problematic. By season four, end of season four, I'm fine with Martin now. He's matured nicely. He is ready to be spread over a delicious cracker and eaten.
For me, it's less a cheese metaphor and more. In season one, Martin was, a fluffy character to unleash some worms on.
Pretty much.
And since then, he's very much deepened. And we always had the overall plan for his arc, but planning an arc and getting a sense of how that arc progresses are two very different things.
This is from Geo. In previous seasons, it has appeared that the only people who have had supernatural encounters have been the ones giving statements to the Magnus Institute. But right. In season four, we've heard about the archivist getting statements from essentially random people on the street. Approximately what percentage of people in the Magnusverse have had an encounter with one of the entities?
Well, I mean, they're random people on the street, but they're random people on the street who have had encounters with the entities. It's not the case that everyone who's had an encounter with the entities has gone to the Magnus Institute. I mean, I haven't really thought about it, but if I was going to just guess a number, I'd say maybe 5-10% of the people in the Magnus world who have had an encounter with the entities have ended up reporting it to the Magnus Institute or one of the other organisations.
And running the numbers in my head on the fly, in order for this universe to make any sense, the percentage of the general population that has been exposed to the genuinely supernatural must be less than about 1%.
I'd say probably everyone has brushed up against them.
Really?
Just in the sense of, like, I mean, everyone has that thing that they're like, no, okay, I'm fine.
But it must be less than 1% of maybe, pursued it in any
Yeah, maybe
way.
Like 10-15% have had, like,
a spook.
A spook. What you might think of as just like a slightly ghostly encounter that is not significant enough to delve into.
Didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, and maybe 0.1% have had a legitimate, like, it's a small enough number that it's not, that they're not going to speak up to anyone who's not like, hey, tell me your story.
Alex, narratologist here. Mm. I recommend anyone interested in that reading up on the technique of writing known as the masquerade. It's a trope or a conceit, the idea being there's the world behind the world, but there's quite a lot of writing on how many people within your world are allowed to see behind that curtain before your world breaks.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into it here. It's a whole field of study, but it's interesting. I'd recommend it. On to another writing question.
Yep.
This one's from Amber. Which would you each consider more important, resolving all the mysteries you created or giving compelling arcs to all the characters you created? Do you ever find there is a difficulty in balancing those two things in the story?
Arcs and yes.
I would agree, for the simple reason that for a character arc, if you've left the character arc unfinished, you are wrong.
Yes.
Like, you've done a bad story. If you leave a mystery unanswered, as long as it is a type of mystery that is allowed to be unanswered.
Yeah. In some way, it's not quite the dichotomy that it might be presented as, because if you know the answer to the mystery when you start the mystery, then not answering it is less of a danger.
As long as it stays consistent, like, you don't change your answer halfway through writing and not like tell anyone, which happens more than you might
think. The danger is the urge to change the mystery to better support character arcs, or to change character arcs to better support the mystery.
Really dangerous.
That's where the, I mean, and that's where the balancing act is. And I think there are a few in Magnus that have slightly changed their shape, or the answers, as they've gotten deeper, effectively, have interacted more with people's character arcs. But this is one of the advantages of writing the mysteries, where the wider answer to the mystery is categorically known at the start, but a lot of the smaller details, a lot of the smaller threads are still unconnected, and those are the things that can be threaded through a character arc. I think an unsatisfying character arc is more of a weakness than an unsatisfying mystery.
I've never thought of it before. I suppose an unanswered character arc is just a mess. An unanswered mystery is still a mystery. It's just an unanswered
one. It's why stuff that is pure mystery tends not to have a character arc.
Yeah.
I mean, you read a Poirot book. Like, Poirot's not having a character
but
arc.
But what if he doesn't solve this one, Johnny?
His character arc is man who has not solved a murder.
Solves a murder.
Arcing into man who has solved a murder. And it's because, yeah, so there's no conflict there between arc and mystery.
I don't know. I'd love to read a Poirot where it's the one where he doesn't solve the mystery and he just has to deal.
Well, I mean, if you do want a Poirot mystery that has an arc for him, Curtin Poirot's Last Case is probably the one, like the last Poirot mystery, because there's an arc.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to say what it is, because spoilers.
You are beyond my sphere of knowledge at this point. Poirot is not something I've done a deep dive on,
well,
I have to admit.
Well, deep dive is really good.
Right, we're going to jump to a
little Belgian solves crimes. It's wonderful.
We're going to jump on to a misc, which is Lucille. How do you feel about the growth of the fan community during this last season and the increase in fan creations, art, cosplay and so on, as well as often high trending on Tumblr after the release?
I mean, short answer, terrified.
Good. The correct answer is good.
It's a really interesting thing, because as the fandom has grown, it's no longer a monolith. It was never a monolith, obviously, but it's no longer a more or less unified group. I need to be a lot more careful how I interact, because things that I would say potentially in jest, like, they have resonance now. I can't have an opinion on my work, because my opinion is not an opinion.
Yes.
My opinion is something that people can take and deploy in fandom context, and it's very much like I have made a big party, and as I've made this big party, I myself have grown so that I am now a huge stone giant. So if he attempts to attend the party, he will destroy the party and everyone will die, because I will crush them with my giant stone hands. That's how I feel.
Oh, you're the kid that made the enormous Lego landscape that got so big you can't play with it anymore.
Yes.
See, I have it far easier. I just have my new shield, which is working really well, which is, mate, I just work here. I'm the mechanic that you bring your story to, and I'm like, well, problem is there, you've got a bus carburetor in, mate, your character art, that's well out, that's going to need completely replacing, mate. Oh. Okay, we're gonna jump onto a cast one again. Cass Landman, which guest voice actor were you most excited or just very excited to have on this season?
That's really hard, actually, because I wasn't here for most of the guest recordings.
This season has had you out of the studio more than any other, actually.
Yeah, like, I really was looking forward to working with Alistair.
How did that go? You had one scene.
We had one scene that we actually recorded
Alistair,
together.
Who plays Peter Lucas, has never been in the same room, apart from once in passing to say hello as the other was leaving, with Ben, who plays Elias. Elias and Peter have never been in the same room for a recording. That's bananas.
Yes. Yeah. Also, John Henry, who played Arthur Nolan. We're friends, but we never really see each other. So I was really looking forward to actually hanging out to do something.
Wasn't there.
I've
met everyone. It's been lovely.
Okay, so yeah, you can answer this question.
So I was very happy to get to work more with Alistair. And I have to, like, in front of everyone, I have to give him a big thanks, because out of everyone, he ran into an enormous technical glitch twice in a row.
Oh, yeah.
Not avoidable, not a thing that we could necessarily prep for. You know, mechanical failures happen, that kind of thing. And the absolute trooper turned up for two massive pickup sessions in a row, recording opposite people who weren't here. So he's recording in isolation, making enormous journeys to do it. So he sort of became my MVP by the end of the season.
He is officially the loveliest man.
I had good fun as well working with Kareem.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just because he had the most fun, where a lot of the direction consisted of, are we thinking more, I want to kill everyone in the room, or are we thinking more like, here are some cookies?
I actually met Kareem for the first time last night, and he's lovely.
I was also really glad to get Fran and Ian, that's Trevor and Julia, back in the studio.
Oh yes, I was there with them, that's fun. I always always enjoy recording with them.
Because not many people know as well, Ian originally started as an editor for us. He was editing with Rusty Quill for like a year, and then suddenly went, also I'm a professional performer. I'm like, well, bury the lead. So yeah, it was good getting them back into the studio. That was good fun. But honestly, this season's kind of been a little bit of a candy store where, yeah, I can say that now. At the time, it meant all casting was a nightmare. But after the fact, it does mean, oh, I got to work with this person and this person. But yeah, I think Alistair has to win most MVP.
And I know he's listening, so he's looking at you.
Okay, I'm going to jump onto a production question.
That was weird. I'm sorry.
This one's from Planets and Magic, and I should have seen this one coming. I'm going to read this in the tone I believe it was intended.
Okay.
Alex, how's it been directing this season? That's a question that's written literally, but is definitely meant as a, how you doing?
I can probably answer it for you, actually, if you'd like.
Go for it.
Directing's been fine. Directing's actually been quite fun. I've got to work with a lot of good people. The editing and production has been bad.
Yeah, it's been a bit hellish this year. There were a couple of issues we had to do with sort of delayed casting and things like that, which meant that we had a lot of very short turnarounds due to stuff happens.
Also, there was
happen.
Oh, what was that? There was something that was happening in September that was big. There was like a massive problem. I remember someone was getting married.
That was not a problem. That was factored in. That was the only thing that was actually fine. That was, yes, I got married. I got married during this season, which was fine. That all went swimmingly.
It was lovely.
But we
got very damp in Wales.
It was a very, very complicated season this year. If I was being cruel, potentially overcomplicated.
That would be cruel.
I don't know what really cut. I feel like anything that we shifted for the sake of production, we bent the story as far as we could before the story would literally change.
If we'd made production easier, we would have made the story worse, which might have been a trade worth making at certain points, but it's not one we did.
So, yeah, there's a reason that we're taking a longer season break and a bigger run-up, because you can only sprint for so long, basically. Yeah. And yeah, editors were real troopers on this one, actually. There was a lot of, with the Alistair stuff's a good example. Hi, you were meant to have a week for this. It went wrong. We did a re-record. It went wrong. You have 2 days to do a week's work. And people stepped up. So yeah, that was amazing. So Johnny's right. Directing, yes. Production, no. On to another story one. This is from Atomic Pleb. As an ace person...
Sorry, it's just a great name.
It is a good name. As an ace person, it really means a lot to have John as asexual representation in a podcast. Can I ask at what point in planning the podcast you decided to make that happen?
That's a very good question, and it's a difficult one to answer because it's one of those where it wormed its way into sort of essentially my headcanon quite early in the writing process. And then later, I think during season two, when it started to actually become more textually relevant, we were discussing it and we nailed down the idea. But it's a tricky question to answer as to at what point that character inkling became a canonical facet.
The issue is it gets muddied up at our end in a way we haven't really discussed before, in that during initial like story development and pitching and so on, it was explicitly stated that the archivist that... You have to discuss what type of story you're telling. And straight out of the gate, we were like, cool, archivist. Does the archivist have any kind of romantic arcs at all through this? And we were both like, this isn't a romance.
Yeah.
It's a horror.
Joke was on us.
Well, yeah. But what that did is that muddied the waters a bit. So genuinely, yeah, headcanon pretty much from the outset. But It sounds silly. The thing is, like, I remember it to be a thing.
The thing is, I remember a conversation at some point during season one where we were sort of discussing what we thought the various characters' sexualities were.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, oh yeah, no, I think John's ace, and Alex was like, yeah, no, that sounds right. But at the same time, that wasn't a planning conversation.
Yeah,
in the
it
same
wasn't
way
us
that...
going. We need to really have a sit down. I think out of everything from the entire series to date, that's been probably the biggest one that's had a largest impact that I most underestimated.
Yeah, I did not anticipate the reaction, and it's lovely. But yeah, I didn't anticipate it would resonate as hard as it has.
It isn't something we put a little red mark on, make sure you handle this correctly. Yeah. Like, I feel like we have.
I think so. Like, but, I don't think we would have made it explicit if we weren't confident we'd done it reasonably thoughtfully.
So we have one question set aside, which is the elephant in the room question, which is a big question, and we knew we'd end up having to answer. Yep. So this one is from, quote, loads of people.
Sure.
Does the archivist / John reciprocate Martin's romantic feelings for him? People have been commenting on the ambiguity of the nature of his feelings, and would there be an explicit authorial confirmation on whether those feelings are romantic or not?
So this is both a very simple answer and a very complicated answer.
Yes.
The simple answer is yes, he reciprocates. It's a romance. At least I have written it as a romance.
It has been intended.
It is intended as a romance. However, there is obviously a much bigger conversation about death of the author, and if that's not how people read it, there. I wrote a lot of drafts of 159, and there were a lot of versions where the archivist's emotional state during it was a lot more explicit, and they all rang incredibly false.
They didn't
because
work.
Unfortunately, we've spent 4 seasons building up a character who
is an emotional
wreck. He's
a mess of a not human.
And so I think the scenes that we ended up having are the most true to the characters. I think there probably will be more explicit aspects to it going into season 5.
I believe so, yeah.
But at the same time, I, as the author, cannot tell people that they are wrong for interpreting things in a different way. Like, I don't think that people who read it as platonic are necessarily, you know, wrong in how they respond to the text. But yeah, authorial intention is it as romantic. But also it's a horror series, and it was the focus of season 4 because it was the emotional core that led to the culmination of the series. Yep. But it's going to take more of a backseat, I think, in season 5.
I think there's 2 things to take away from it. Is one, you can't tell someone how to receive a text, and you shouldn't tell someone how to receive a text, because that's not how art works. So if someone is receiving a text differently to you, that's fine. The other one I would say that's quite important is the ambiguity in 159 especially was not intended as a way of being deliberately ambiguous so people were left guessing.
I'll be
it
honest.
It was a symptom of accurate characterization in terms of how they communicate with one another.
I'll be honest, I mean, to me, it was very much like a culmination of a love story scene. And it saddens me a bit that the fact that there wasn't the specific words, yes, I love you too, Martin.
And then they kiss. Yeah.
Oh, that is one thing I will say unequivocally. You will never hear a kiss in the Magnus archives, because audio-only kisses are the worst thing in the world.
They sound terrible. Like, it's not an option.
No one is kissing in the Magnus archives.
There are a couple of ways of making it less offensive on the ear, but it still sounds like someone's eating chewing gum at you.
Yeah.
It doesn't work on audio, I'm afraid. It never will. It's the nature of humans and ears. No one likes other people kissing in their ears in that way. It doesn't work.
So, yeah, fundamentally, it is intended as a romance. It will continue to be so through season 5, though it will not be the focus. But at the same time, if you interpret it differently, if your reactions to the text are different, I mean, you're not wrong.
Because it's art. That's how art works. Cool. A separate writing question now.
Yes, yes.
This one's from Dr. Brainbox. Have the predictions / theories on Reddit influenced your storytelling in any way?
Short answer, no. I use the different social medias to sort of check different things. Discord, I generally use to check the immediate fan reaction to an episode. Twitter, I mean, that tends to be where I actually engage with people. Tumblr, I use to check how the emotional arcs of characters are being received. And Reddit, I use to check how many people are successfully guessing, well, were successfully guessing about the mystery. Because generally, with any given mystery, you want a few people on Reddit to be right about it, and quite a few to be kind of right about it, and a few more to be absolutely wrong.
And I really, my favourite is if someone's absolutely wrong and the loudest in the room.
Yeah, that's great. But occasionally you'll stumble across a thread and you'll be like, oh no, that's exactly, you've got it.
I can say this now, there's been at least one, maybe two, this is across all social media, so there's no way you'll be able to track them down, who said, hi, I have a little pet theory. It's probably nothing. Blah, blah, blah. And then just laid it out. Just laid out every beat. The
and
whole
be like,
lot's there.
Yes, you
and
got
like,
it,
good
mate.
For you. And then about 40 people will come in going, I'm not so sure.
Or like actually quite a few people will write, that's a good theory, but there's this or this or this. Yeah, that means that it probably won't be the case.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you have a reveal of a mystery, you want a good balance of people feeling validated, mm-hmm. people feeling sort of half validated, half surprised, and people who just straight up didn't see it coming. And so I tend to use Reddit to check where people are sitting on that sort of scale.
From Mellybean, a lot of fans were throwing around theories and two big ones turned out to be true, specifically the Jonah-Elias overlap mm-hmm. and the Watcher's Crown. Is it cool that the fans have managed to predict this, or is it incredibly frustrating and annoying?
No, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. Like, it means that you've done the job right.
Yeah, absolutely. The prioritization of shocking everyone with a big twist is the bane of long-term mystery writing.
It is a trap.
Because over the long term, if you've done enough foreshadowing that the twist is going to feel earned, people are going to guess it. And if you see that guess happening and you feel, oh no, they've guessed the twist, I need to change the twist, it's a trap. You're absolutely shooting your mystery in the foot and making it much less satisfying, just because you don't realise that half the joy of a solved mystery is the validation of the people who got it right.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, feel free if people are getting too close to throw more red herrings in the mix.
Oh, yeah.
But that's different. There's the old adage, what? An ending needs to be both surprising and inevitable.
Yeah.
That is true. What it doesn't mean is that your ending needs to shock the very foundations of every reader.
Yeah.
What it just means is that more people will go, ah, that's it. That's the goal, is a little, ah.
Also, the more people have predicted the twist, the better you need to write the reveal, fundamentally.
Yeah, that's fair, actually. It does raise the stakes,
like,
in terms
I'm
of delivery.
I'm very, very happy with how we actually dealt with the Jonah Elias reveal, because everyone had kind of guessed it. It's something we'd foreshadowed quite heavily. So we really went all out on the flavour, the actual the actual writing of the reveal, so that it's not a, oh my God, I never guessed. It's, yes, I was right, and this is really cool.
There's a benefit, actually, to not reinventing the world. Well, I mean, okay, bad choice of words. But your reveal doesn't have to be so enormous, because it reduces the expositionary load as well.
Yeah.
If you need to have a massive, enormous shocker that's coming from nowhere, that means that your villain has to sit down and monologue. And I don't mean monologue like we got away with. I mean proper, so 2 weeks ago I did this and then I did that. We've managed to cover it up to a degree, but the more that your mystery makes sense and you aren't having to do that shoehorning in at the end, the less clunky it's going to feel.
Yeah. Like our monologue, I was quite happy because it was mainly recontextualizations.
Yeah, exactly.
It was saying, oh yeah, remember this thing? Actually, it fits in this way. As opposed to, well, in order to support this twist, here's some new information.
Yeah, yeah. So this is from 4 Chinchillas, 1 Raincoat. Presumably an undersized raincoat. Chinchillas, not very large.
But if they get wet, you've got to dry them very carefully and make sure they get a dust bath. Otherwise, they can go mouldy and die.
It's true.
Their fur is so dense, it does not dry naturally.
It's true. What's been the worst normal job you've ever had?
All of them.
I will jump in here.
Day jobs are bad.
And say my track record for work is longer than it should be due to me starting way younger than I should have. And additionally, most of my first jobs as a result were really illegal enterprises that got shut down. I was not being illegal.
I didn't know this.
So I can run through the list. There was one job where it turned out every Monday they hired people.
Right.
You worked with them for a week and then they fired everyone on the Friday. But they said, of course, come back on Monday and we'll rehire you. Meaning that their tax outlay for all employment was zero. Meaning that they had all these sales-based things that were not applicable. That's one example. There's been another one.
A fine education for an entrepreneur.
There was another one where it was fine, but I got told off a lot because I wrote something down at some point. Turned out that the cost of shredders for the immediate evacuation of the office, if it was audited, was so high that they were like, just remember things, because they couldn't afford the shredders to shred their records. Yep. Like, my work history is checkered and messy with other people's immoral decisions.
My work history is broadly dull. I've generally worked a series of just incredibly medium, low-key demoralising, but fundamentally not egregious office jobs. We actually met at one of my favourite jobs, actually.
Genuinely one of the cushiest gigs I ever got.
So it was night shift. 7 days on, seven days off, and you'd get in at 10:30, you'd leave at 6:30, and you'd spend the evening. It was a media monitoring company, so you were writing article summaries and checking that everything that had come into the system had come in correctly, and there weren't any sort of irrelevant or like articles that whatever client wouldn't want to see, and then you were hitting the space bar to reject them. And it was silent.
Utterly silent. I've never heard 80 people at one point. Yeah. Just pure silence.
It took about 40% of your brain, and the rest... This was about, 6 years ago now?
I spun up a company at the same time as working it, in the same office, on the same computers at some point.
And
great.
I was listening to... This was before the sort of the podcast boom had really hit.
Yeah.
So I was listening to a lot of Pseudopod and a lot of...
Please tell me Lights Out.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Like, this was when I... Because there weren't as many sort of horror podcasts.
Yep.
I found this archive of old vintage radio shows, and I was listening to sort of Nightfall from the 80s, and Lights Out with all its ionised yeast adverts. £5 to £10 of good new flesh.
Good new flesh.
I'm just so tired of this war job of mine. I sure am discouraged.
If only I had more flesh.
Say, why don't you try ionised yeast? It costs just pennies a day. Maybe you need more vitamin B12 and iron. And we sort of met in the not silent but still pretty subdued kitchen of that job.
True.
Though we didn't actually start working together for a couple of till I'd actually left that left that job.
We met but didn't really do anything.
We met and got on really well.
Yeah.
And then the year I left, you came to see the Max up at
We got on really well. Johnny kept going on about this weird creative gig that he was doing. It's like, I'm sure it's good. I'm sure it's fine. Like, sure. And then I actually took a punt and went, oh no, it's really good. I'm the bad person. Oh. It was really good.
To be fair, you say that, but like the number of friends I have who do really good creative things, and every time they're like, oh yeah, I've been working on this, and I'm like, I still haven't gotten around to actually
a little bit
watch it. So I can't really I can't really be mad at anyone else for not...
Well, I've said it before, I have bought 4 albums in my life: Paul Simon's Graceland and 3 Mechanisms albums. That's it, that's all the albums I've ever bought.
We've gone a little bit off topic
I'm going to bring it back on. We're going to bring it back on. Okay, cool. Good question from, is it Flaming or Flammin' Cobbold?
I think it's Flammin' Cobbold. Okay. One of our vintage fans.
So was it intended to have Alex play Jared Hopworth, or was that a late decision out of necessity? And how far did that influence the voice distortion in that episode? There's about 3 layers to this question.
Yep.
First one is there were casting issues. which made things awkward. So we do a casting system where there's like a tier of people, where there's like six people per role, and then you have like a highest preference and lowest preference, and it's not based on talent. A lot of it's based on like availability and stuff like that. So ultimately we were working our way through the list.
It's one of those things about this industry, certainly like at this level, is being able to show up on time and like get stuff done is often a lot more important than being the absolute best voice actor in the room.
The sad truth is there is no shortage of talent in the world, but there is arguably a shortage of conscientiousness sometimes. So
sometimes.
It sounds strange, but yeah, turning up on time is a big plus. So as it stood, we ended up with...
Full disclosure, I overslept this morning and was an hour late.
But he's not been an hour late every single time.
No. And sometimes you know. 2 hours.
So, in terms of Jared Hopworth, we actually ended up going through pretty much all of our choices quite quickly. Also, we did something that you shouldn't ever do. Don't do... Avoid this, kids.
Learn from our mistakes.
Don't smoke behind the bike sheds. And also, don't go, oh, you know what? Actually, this person that we were going to cast as Jared Hopworth would work really even better in this other role.
Oh, yeah.
And then just slowly exhaust your Jared Hopworth options, going, well, they're going to be better here. They're going to be better here. And then we suddenly realised that we'd given away all our Jared Hopworths.
Well, not, and the ones that we hadn't given away couldn't, turned out.
Literally couldn't
make it.
They weren't in the country, things like that. So then I ended up doing a test audio showing that I could do it. However, it is a bit frustrating to me in that it didn't need as much vocal messing around as it had. The reason for a lot of them vocal messing around is it's in the corridors.
Oh,
and the corridors are the messed up soundscape that there actually is. Like, it's the one that changes speech the most.
We were changing Alex's voice so it wasn't as recognisable. We were adding in some meat sounds because meat sounds, they're good. And then we were also adding corridor distortion for just a cocktail of, in retrospect, potentially an optimum.
Yeah, so we ended up in a situation where it ended up having a lot more effects than you really should squeeze into MP3, but it was just a story's things that are unavoidable. He's a man made of meat in a corridor made of unreality, who is 3 to 5 times the size of a normal human being. Like,
sorry.
These things stack up. So this is a nice quick one that relates to stuff we said earlier, which is Saz Andorable. You've both talked in the past about the problem of including swearing in the show. What was the process that led to Martin, who's being known for being polite and voiced by Alex, drop an F-bomb?
I wrote it in the script. Alex looked at it and said, yeah, this is the right time. And I said, yeah, isn't it? Because while it wasn't the most plot bomb revelation, from a personal point of view, from the character's point of view, this was possibly the biggest discovery. This was the discovery that most recontextualized everything about their situation.
Plus, I mean, from a sake of script efficiency, I can't even is 3 words.
Yeah.
And that expletive is 2 words. So, you know, it's an optimum choice.
It just, we drafted the scene a couple of times and that was easily the best version of it.
Plus, it was funny.
It was funny.
I like funny.
And also, shortly after we'd recorded it, I stumbled across the fact that there was a Tumblr that was called something like Has Martin Blackwood Said Yet.
Oh yeah, well, we hadn't. We weren't aware of it until after we'd done the recording, which
was
quite
like,
nice.
Oh, you sweet summer child, you don't realise you're a countdown.
Right, I'm going to jump onto another story
along
because we're getting through these now, which is nice. This is from Bo Jester Real. Did the desolation really kill Gertrude's cat? And was that her primary motivation for waging war on the fears? Because that's pretty realistic for a cat person.
I don't know.
There are some mysteries, as we've established, that don't need answers.
Although, I've gotten a very small amount of trouble for this. Because my stated policy, one of the stated rules of Magnus, is if we meet an animal, if we meet a pet, specifically, it won't come to harm within the episode. And some people feel that Gertrude's theoretical possible cat breaches that rule, which I personally disagree with, because, I mean, there is animal death in the Magnus archives. Mm-hmm. The point of the rule comes out of arachnophobia with Major Tom, because we actually got a surprising amount of feedback saying that people were having legitimate difficulty listening through the episode because as soon as Major Tom was introduced, it took them out of it because they were too busy worrying about the well-being of the cat to actually properly engage with the horror. So it's very much... So while also I don't particularly like violence against animals or animal death in this sort of thing, but it is very much a practical rule saying, no, if you meet an animal, if you meet a pet specifically, within the context of an episode, you don't need to worry about it dying. You can assume it's safe and engage with the story.
A better way to say it'd be, if in all of these historical accounts that we've had from Gertrude, there was a cat present that Gertrude was spending loads of time with,
and having
a chill, you don't kill the cat as a punishment for another character.
But at the same time, I don't feel like saying that there might theoretically have been a cat who died 50 years ago actually breaches that rule. Also, it might not have existed. It might have been a joke. I don't know.
No, you heard it here first, everyone. Johnny Sims hates cats.
I have two cats.
Hates cats.
Don't say this thing.
Okay, we're on to a writing one again. This is from Chris Sterling. Was it your intent from the get-go to have every major character in the Magnus Archives being some flavour of queer, or was it just a coincidence?
I mean, not from the beginning.
I would go so far as to say neither.
No.
We didn't have, like, a checkbox list that we have to hit, but similarly, coincidence implies that you're just kind of freewheeling it and you don't put any thought in.
Well, there were some that we obviously put thought in because the relationships are important, and like there are plenty of characters whose sexuality has never been explicitly addressed. Also, you get a lot of straight characters out there. It's nice to have some others.
It opens story options up as well. If you're gonna be a horrible puppet master story writer, you get more options with a broader palette of characters.
I mean, that's
you
true.
Just do. It makes things easier, not harder.
Yeah.
Follow-up question related to that from Eliza. How do you avoid tropes like queer baiting and bury your gaze as a thing when writing?
A lot of it is just trying to be thoughtful, be aware of these tropes, and have a wide enough context and a diverse enough cast and world that you have story options, but they don't necessarily push you into these problematic tropes.
Yeah, I couldn't really add anything to that. It's as straightforward as you can really get in an answer.
It's like there are plenty of female characters who do conform to certain, this isn't a great stereotype.
Sure.
But at the same time, there are enough female characters that it's not, there's one female character and she is this problematic stereotype.
Yeah. Honestly, if you just have a broad enough set of people within your world that's
properly balanced, you treat them like people,
and you all treat everyone the same.
You treat them like characters rather than like types.
We're going to move across then to another MISC one. Mm-hmm. This is from Abigail, and also I know a few people have asked this. But were there any good cows?
I mean, obviously, that's
a great,
daft question. You ever seen Scottish cows?
Cows.
They're great. They're these fluffy, shaggy things.
And depending where you go, like they're left alone for a month at a time, easy, if not more. They're just
utterly unguarded, easily huggable.
Doing their own thing.
I cannot take any responsibility for anyone who attempts to hug a Highland cow. So if you injure yourself doing so, that's not on me. That's Alex's fault.
I mean, statistically speaking, they're one of the most dangerous animals.
Really?
A lot of people act really dumb around cows, and that's why.
Huh.
A cow is, when you get up close, spot Alex, who grew up in the middle of nowhere, and it doesn't come up that often. Cows are both very, very big and meaty animals that everyone thinks are dumb and you can do anything you want around them. That tends to go badly. Being dumb around cows is the same as being dumb around any other animal.
So you heard it here second? Don't be dumb around cows.
Oh.
But there were good cows.
Oh, they were great cows.
Scotland's full of them.
Okay, we are going to jump all the way back around to a cast run then. This is for you, mm-hmm. Johnny. Well, sort of for you. You'll see what I'm getting at.
Okay.
So this is from Gilligan Mungus.
Okay.
Red as written. Does your mom know...
Sorry, my what?
Mom. Etymologically, I think it is related to the word mother.
Oh, my mum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, that'll
be
it. Yes. Does your mum know how much the fandom absolutely loves her portrayal of Gertrude? What does she think of her immense popularity?
She's vaguely aware. I haven't actually spoken to her about it since 160 dropped.
Neither have I, actually.
Yeah, no, she's having a real good time in terms of the reception of Gertrude. I remember early in season four, I'd given her a script for Gertrude being particularly ruthless about something. She gave me a call and we were arranging the recording. She's like, Gertrude, I mean, you know, she's a bit of a bee, isn't she? And I was like, yes, mother, she's quite ruthless. So, yeah, she's having a real good time with it.
Basically, I was really disappointing this season because I didn't allow a cackle.
What? She gave a cackle?
No, she was begging to give a cackle. She's like, can I cackle here? It's not... Gertrude's not really a cackler.
She's not a cackler.
But it's such a good cackle moment, and word for word. And Alex, you may not be aware, but I have an excellent cackle. Here,
let me
cackle for you. It was an excellent cackle.
But do we have it on tape?
Yes, there is.
Patreon
buried
bonus.
Somewhere. I will see if I can't find it. Your mum does an excellent cackle, but Gertrude's not a cackler.
No, she's not.
And your mum was well disappointed by that. This is from AGVZ.
Grand.
Season 4 was my favourite so far in terms of sound design. What is your creative process for building soundscapes, and has this changed over the course of the series?
My process.
What's your
is
process?
My process for
Give
designing.
Give an example of your stage
my,
direction,
my,
Johnny.
My process for designing stage directions is I'll have an idea, and then I'll write it in as unhelpful or counterintuitive a way as possible. Such as The World Goes Wrong is a classic.
I feel like you may have done one somewhere, although this might have been season 2, where it's something you genuinely put some version of, it's all a bit much. Something like that. It's all a bit much.
That sounds about
it's just
right.
Like,
in my defense, it was all a bit much, Alex.
What does that mean? It's all a
and
bit
then,
much.
And then I'll hand it over to Alex, and Alex will say,
cool. I
so
need
what
to
does
know,
this mean?
I need to know. Interior. Exterior.
And I'll be like,
day,
and I'll be
weather.
Like, interior or exterior? What a good question conceptually, given this space exists outside of time. And then Alex will say, just go away, I'll figure it out.
Well, no, we have interior, exterior, and Eldritch. That's fine. Eldritch is fine. It means
E-L-D.
Try and make it sound weird without making the speech unintelligible, which is fine until we're revisiting an old Eldritch and you can't pull the same tricks, i.e. Jared Hopworth situation.
Yes.
So interior, exterior, weather, time of day, and I think I added an extra...
They all just happen at some point, Alex. I don't think time of day is really... Like, no one cares about
I added
what time
an extra criteria I haven't told Johnny, which I have been keeping a note of, which is an extra column in there, which is nonsense, ? Which is
They're
what
nonsense
has Johnny forgotten to mention? Where it'd be the kind of thing where you'd do this, and then he'd be like, oh, I didn't write, there is a brass band... playing the entire time. I don't know how
I've never put in a brass band.
But that kind of thing. In terms of how you build it,
it was woodwind.
Unfortunately, I've made a bit of a rod for my own back in Magnus, in that we have a very set of consistent rules regarding soundscaping that people have picked up on in a good way. So stuff like static applies in certain situations and doesn't.
Yeah.
Types of static are different, that kind of thing, which means that handover in terms of soundscaping is a bit of a nightmare at this stage.
It's a weird one as well, because it means that there's a lot of theory that's been built around different sorts of static. Static is something I've been very bad about consistently writing into script.
Oh, it's been consistent from my end.
Yes, I know.
To the point where I've had to insist on extra stage directions to pick out when something's compelled or not, things like that. But the secret, dirty secret, I don't like admitting, which is that at Magnus, I'm still doing the soundscaping.
Yeah.
Vocals are done by a couple of people. Elizabeth Moffat, I'm going to shout out in this one. She's been really good this season. She's excellent, actually.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Brock Winstead has been doing most of the music. I think it's been one or two.
Oh, we actually shot him as well.
Yes, we did. He is the
he's the
cop.
The police officer in America.
I forgot the cop's name.
Musterman?
Yes, he's Musterman. So he got shot
because he is actually American. So we were like, hey, can you be an American cop and then get shot by an old man?
and
he said yes.
In terms of soundscaping, it's a big thing I can't go into here. Like, I could run workshops on it that would last a long time. But generally speaking, the best way that we do is you find out where the thing is happening. You add in 3 layers. You need a close layer, a mid layer, and a far layer. And you need a bass layer, a mid layer, and a treble layer. How those two interact, so you could have distant treble and close layer. You basically have to hit those, otherwise your soundscape's going to feel a bit flat. There's an exception of the archivist's office, which is a dead room and has been from the beginning. But beyond that, it's a lot of finding the right sound effects or recording one yourself, and then tweaking a tenth of a second 50, 60 times, and lots of listen to it, not right, listen to it, not right, and just trial and error. I'd love to say there's a magic source that isn't. It's just you keep pouring time in and stuff comes out the other end.
Alex is radically overcomplicating it, as always. You just write it in italics.
You know what? Johnny's right.
You just left the line at right in italics. It's fine.
Or,
square brackets. That's
or
the
you
key.
Don't write it in italics, and then you just go, oh, yeah, that
oh,
is
and then
in
you
a,
remind
that
you remind
a thing
them
after
later.
The fact.
Yeah, no, that's it's actually very simple.
Don't request soundscape changes after it's recorded. That's it. That's a good one.
I've never done that.
Johnny's never done that. Don't do that. I'm not gonna. That's a no-no.
I'm not gonna.
Although, actually,
I was listening back to 160.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking...
Mm-hmm. Don't do that. You're to write. Right, okay, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep going. This is a store-related one, which I know a lot of people have asked. Didn't Martin say that Gertrude had been shot at least 3 times when he saw the body? Yet, the recording of Elias only has 1 gunshot.
Something happened in the sound editing. Some might say that
the tape
someone,
finished before he took the next 2 shots.
Someone might say that certain soundscapers misread the script.
The tape stopped and Elias took 2 more shots.
Yeah, so basically what happened, like, in canon, and this is the one time I will 100%, this is word of God, after the tape stopped, turned out Gertrude was too much of a badass to die from just a single gunshot. She lunges at Elias. Elias screams like a scared child and fires wildly 3 times. Misses. Gertrude gets a machete from under the desk.
Cackling.
Lunges at him, but 2 more shots to the chest and Gertrude finally goes down. It's not that Alex misread the script.
I need this formally on the record, okay? Because this is the kind of thing that can get away from us. Hi, everyone. This is Alex. Speaking as Alex. This isn't even like Alex as character. This is just Alex being Alex. This isn't a thing. The fact that there was 1 gunshot there is not a thing. It's not. It's just... I think I made a gaffe over 160 episodes, and I'm sorry. I've disappointed you, but more importantly, I've disappointed myself.
You've disappointed my mother, Alex.
I categorically haven't. Your mum loves me. She thinks I'm great. Tell you what, we can do a George Lucas, and in 10 years we can remaster it, and Gertrude shot first.
Yep.
Oh, that all got real. Oh, I'm so disappointed.
That's all right. I'm sorry, mate.
This is from Bone God. It's from Bone God. If we were to take 1 lesson moral away from the story thus far, what would you like it to be? Sometimes, okay, people make mistakes in editing, and that's okay, and it doesn't need
it's
to
important
be...
important to forgive.
It doesn't need to be lingered on.
It's important
on.
To forgive.
A lesson or moral?
Oh, God. It's a really difficult one, because Magnus, certainly seasons 3 and 4, have, for me, been an examination of a lot of questions about choice and responsibility and what your responsibilities, I guess, are when you find yourself in situations, which we all do, where you are beholden to forces larger than yourself, and the idea that what you can do is constrained and what the results of your choices are unclear, and you can take actions and you can do things and the results of those actions aren't actually up to you. But that's very much me working through a lot of my own thoughts, but I don't really have an explicit moral. It's a really difficult question, a difficult situation, both in the show and in real life. It's like, I've seen there's quite a lot of discussion about the ending of 160 and whether it means that, for instance, all Gertrude's actions were pointless, or whether Tim died for nothing.
Oh, yeah, good point.
And it's a real complicated question, because on the one hand, I mean, kind of, yes. Like, this is horror on a cosmic scale, and one of the cornerstones of cosmic horror is fundamentally that the actions of the individual, broadly speaking, are never going to do good.
Pretty much.
But, for instance, Tim, he didn't actually save the world. But that wasn't really what he was there for. He was there for revenge.
Hmm.
Nobody involved knew quite how pointless, I guess, their whole...
But people were telling him, please don't go off on a massive revenge spree because it won't fix your problem.
But also, it is still very much the closure of his arc. I mean, very few of us actually get our real-life arcs closed saving the world. That doesn't mean that they're pointless.
It's my most favourite way to start a story. It sounds peculiar. There's nothing I enjoy more than starting a story with a death that is not significant. So not a death that is an opening to a mystery. It's a personal preference of, I love a character has died, And that's just a thing that's happened as opposed to something that you hang a coat off, if you know what I mean.
But no, like, Tim's story is a tragedy, but I don't think it's the revelation of its lack of meaningful consequence within the wider universe invalidates those choices. Like, the choices we take are our choices regardless of what their actual result turns out to be.
Yeah.
It's the same with Gertrude. I mean, in many ways, Gertrude is kind of me working through a lot of my thoughts on the idea of, you know, the ends justify the means. Because Gertrude does full-on atrocities. She does horrible, ruthless things in order to, from her point of view, save the world. And turns out, at the very end, she didn't need to. And even that those actions fundamentally spurred the course that that brings about that end. And it's the idea that the ends may justify the means, but you can never be sure what those ends are actually going to be.
Gertrude is an excellent demonstration of something I've been doing a lot of reading about in the last year, just pure, like, personal interest. If you're interested, look into both the mathematics and the actual just philosophy of existential risks as a thing.
Yeah.
There's a huge amount of writing, which I think people will start to realise there's a lot of Gertrude in there, which is talking about if there is an existential risk where literally everything's at stake, there is an argument to be made that all acts are moral if they mitigate that. It is not to be clear, this isn't a stance, this is a philosophical...
You heard it here first, folks.
Oh,
Alex.
Yes.
Wants to just do a lot of murder to save the world.
But if I put the entire world at risk first, it makes all of my actions fine.
Oh, that's smart. Loophole.
But in all seriousness, Gertrude's a good example of that because it's a good way of tying back into the cosmic horror, which is the world is complicated and it actively doesn't like you.
Yeah, so it's an uncaring, hostile universe.
How do you deal with that? Generally speaking, as a character, you either find your own meaning, which means that how it interacts with the wider world, as long as your own meaning is intact, is okay, which I'd argue Tim sort of hits that note.
Yeah.
Or you engage on the Gertrude route, which is no, all of this is determined externally, in which case you get in some really weird personal morality because one of them's got to give. You can't have both. You can't be objectively and subjectively in the right, really. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. So I don't think there are any core morals of Magnus. You create fictional spaces that they're not necessarily direct metaphors, but they work in a space where people can put metaphorical frameworks on them and see how they stretch.
And there's nothing more didactic than going in and saying, "Here is the takeaway lesson."
Yeah, and also because there is no, like, there are no easy answers to these questions that can be neatly popped in podcast format.
Yeah,
you know, like people have put like, obviously, people quite often put an anti-capitalist sort of metaphorical framework over Magnus, which 100% works. But it's not quite as simple as the entities are a metaphor for capitalism.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The entities can be a metaphor for a lot of things. And I hope that Magnus provides people a space to work through their own thoughts on stuff.
Mm. Okay, so we're going to round up this first Q&A with one last question.
Okay.
This is from Chucking Woods 2000. Alex.
So Chucking 2000 Woods?
No, Chucking Woods 2000.
Chucking a wood 2000 times?
Chucking, or, okay, it's...
Or clear, the 2000th?
It's clearly
the 2000th Chucking
it's
Wood.
It's clearly a 1970s horror based on, like, How Much Wood Would Woodchuck Chuck, but the remake in the 2000s where it's like a reboot.
Or it's just a name, Chucking Wood, and there have been 1,999 ancestors of identical names.
Let's assume that. So, Chucking Woods the 2000th, I guess, according to Johnny. Alex, picture this. Johnny just fell into a lake.
Oh, no!
Drunkenly waving the complete season 5 script in his hand.
God!
Do you save him first, abandoning the script, or do you just take the script and go home? Okay, I'm really sorry, Chucking Woods.
Why did I drink so much?
You have fundamentally misunderstood the level of paranoia that I have. I rescue Johnny, laugh at the script that's kicking around in there, knowing that if Johnny hasn't got multiple digital redundants cloud saved in separate locations, that on his head be it, and I'll put him back in the water. So honestly, I don't feel like there's much of a quandary there, because if he hasn't...
Yeah, I mean, this scenario assumes that Alex hasn't pushed me into the lake, because he was dissatisfied with the season 5 script.
You know what? That's also a valid point. If Johnny is in there with the only copy of the script, Johnny deserves to be in there because he has violated all of the safety protocols, and I can't be held responsible for what I do in that situation.
But the core question of whether Alex sees me as a valued friend or a writing machine, I think is...
And I think that pretty much wraps up the Q&A for this episode. We'll be returning with another one because we had way too many questions.
So many questions.
We're basically going to do an anticlimactic bye followed by immediately carrying on at this end.
Bye!
This episode is distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit rustyquill.com, tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.
Na, noch keine Pläne fürs Wochenende? Besucht die Rotkäppchen-Erlebniswelt in Freiburg mit euren Mädels, der Oma oder dem Knallertypen von nebenan. Wir lieben alle Jahrgänge. Entdeckt unsere interaktive Ausstellung bei der Erlebnistour mit Audioguide und einem Glas Sekt und genießt im Pavillon die ganze Welt von Rotkäppchen. Die Rotkäppchen-Erlebniswelt, nur eine Sektlänge entfernt.
Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice in the Magnus Protocol, and I'm here to tell you about From the Library of Jürgen Leitner, an upcoming novel available for pre-order right now at rustyquill.com/novel. Return to the world of the Magnus Archives in From the Library of Jürgen Leitner, an official prequel novel written by Nebula, World Fantasy and Aurora award-winning author Primi Mohammed, with the help of the Magnus Archives' own writer and lead voice, Jonathan Sims. From the Library of Jürgen Leitner explores an infamous organization from the Magnusverse for the first time, the perilous private library of the enigmatic collector Jürgen Leitner, where occult books are guarded and researched at a fatal cost. Leitner's library keeps the dangers of these books in check and their would-be readers safe, or so Leitner claims. For two of Leitner's employees, the risks are worth it. For Hugh Franklin, the library is a place to belong. For Sebastian Everett, the library is an opportunity to indulge arcane ambitions. Though their 10 years at the library were years apart, Hugh and Sebastian's stories unfold in parallel, and their footsteps echo down the same eerie aisles, caught in a web spun long before either ever heard the name Jürgen Leitner. Will they find a way out, or will the library consume them before it's too late? From the Library of Jürgen Leitner will be published on October the 27th, 2026, and is available for pre-order now. Visit rustyquill.com/novel for more information. That's rustyquill.com/NOVEL.